This podcast is brought to you by SUM, the School of Meaningful Experiences. For more information, visit www.sum.education. That's www.some.edu/CATION. Hello there. My name is Rakesh Kodwani. Welcome to Plunge. A few days ago, my family and I drove out of the city to recharge ourselves and spend a day amidst nature. This place is nestled in the forest, grows its own food, and has no telecom or TV network. So all we had to do was play, eat, talk, walk, and eat again till it becomes so dark that you have no option but to sleep. Early next morning, we all went on a short trek along with some other families. Our guide, a chirpy young man, born and brought up in that village, led the way. We crossed many rocky hills and snaked through the forest. The terrain was not easy, but everyone gave a helping hand to one another and we marched on. There were few teens in our group and they were the most enthusiastic lot as compared to their parents. Obviously, what sensible adult would want to wake up at 5 in the morning and walk on the hills? But wait, what has this story got to do with this episode? Actually, this story is very important for this episode because a very interesting event happened in the last leg of our trek. That event cleared a lot of things in my mind about fears, uncertainties, doubts, also known as FUD, that I spoke about in the last episode. To keep things simple, I will just use the term fear instead of breaking them into FUD. The story answered how fear impacts our lives, mostly negatively, but sometimes positively also. Like for example, fear helps us to stay away from a pan of boiling hot oil. But fear also stalls us from doing many things, like taking a plunge to follow our calling and enjoy our zones. This is what I want to focus on in this episode. Why do we stall from taking a plunge and follow our calling? What are we so afraid of? We will get into all of this in a bit. So let me take you back to my trekking experience. After an hour into it, we told the guide that we want to go back and enjoy the hot breakfast waiting for us. But our young guide had some other plans. He pointed to a boulder in front of us and said that this is the last point for all of us to enjoy before we head back. I personally saw no enjoyment in that sight. It was an ugly-looking boulder, roughly 30 feet high. What was I missing? So I looked back at him. I guess he understood my bewildered look and said, "Sir, you have to climb up that boulder. Great view of the valley." My senses immediately took over and I retorted, "Climb that without any safety gear? It has death written all over it. One slip and you could break every bone as you land on the solid rock that we were all standing on." But our guide kept smiling and said, "It is very easy, sir. Come, I'll show you." And with that, he hopped on this big boulder, balanced himself on one of the edges, and gestured to all of us to follow him. A young girl of 14 or 15 named Isha stepped forward. Her mum encouraged her. I protested and cited the lack of safety measures. But she seemed cool as cucumber and started to climb up. The guide extended his hand to help her. Suddenly, she shrieked. All of us looked in horror because we thought she had slipped. But thankfully, we were all wrong. She was still balanced on the ledge, but was frozen. Her face was not cool anymore. I saw terror in her eyes as she stared at something right in front of her. It was a spotted black newt, something like a lizard, about 4 inches in length. "They're quite common on these boulders," said the guide. All of us were relieved. "It's just a tiny newt after all," I thought. But Isha, the same girl who showed no fear to climb a dangerous boulder, was now scared as a mouse who had seen a cat. Her mum, the same lady who was encouraging Isha to climb up, was equally scared and declared that she's not climbing the boulder. She was fine with the lack of safety equipment on the boulder, but she was not fine with a tiny 4-inch newt hiding somewhere in its crevices. I was puzzled by this behavior, and it triggered many questions in my mind. How can the same event create different types of reactions in different people? And how can the same person demonstrate completely different reactions to events that others react totally different to? In this case, I was scared as hell from the climb on the boulder, but Isha was not. And Isha was scared as hell of the newt, but I was not. Contrast this to a question many of us ask in this journey of plunge. Few of us are not afraid to take a plunge, but majority are scared to do so. If we find the answer to what caused me and Isha to behave differently, hopefully it'll answer the question on why many of us don't take the plunge. So back to the boulder, Isha and the newt. I saw that Isha was still scared and was staring at the newt, who showed no intention of going anywhere soon. It was his boulder after all, and we were the ones who were trespassing on his property. But soon enough, the guide shooed it away and made way for Isha to climb her way to the top. Her face became calm again, and she was enjoying the view. All other teens followed Isha. Even their mums climbed up. It was a funny sight, actually. They all seemed to love it up there. And I stayed down, still scared as hell of the boulder. On our way back, I chatted with Isha a little bit. I asked her what happened up there. She said that she hated lizards and reptiles because when she was a little kid, a lizard had fallen on her and she had developed a phobia from then on. I then asked her, "How come you were not scared of that boulder at all?" And she responded, "Actually, I like adventure and have done this kind of rock climbing before." Both experiences left different memories in her mind and shaped her life. It is so strange, isn't it? What scared the hell out of me gave joy to someone else. And what scared the hell out of someone else was totally cool for me to deal with. What seemed uncertain or doubtful to me was certain and sure for someone else. Our fears, uncertainties, and doubts come from our own experiences or imaginations from our own backgrounds that include our cultural influences, biases, and beliefs as well. But there's something else worth knowing here. Besides the experiences of the events that shape our behavior, we miss out the secret of how that experience is remembered in our brain attics. For Isha, the experience of having a lizard on her would have been quite unpleasant, but it also left an extremely distasteful memory in her mind. So whenever she sees a newt or a lizard or any reptile, this memory is triggered. And the distastefulness of this memory makes her behave in a particular way. Like in this case, she froze and was terrified of it. Similarly for Isha, the experience of climbing up a boulder would have been different. It could have been tough at first, but probably she made an effort to overcome the difficulty, and when she would have reached the top, she would have felt elated. Maybe her mum would have clapped for her, and the memory of this event that is stored in her mind would be that of positivity, happiness, and elation. So whenever Isha saw a boulder on her adventure ahead of her, this memory is triggered and she behaved accordingly. Like in this case, she would not hesitate to climb it up. Our fears are actually memories of an event that have left deep impressions on our lives. Research also shows that these events need not be factual, Sometimes our memories are influenced by events that may not have happened as well. These events could be stories from books or movies or just a figment of our wild imagination. Like, for example, if Isha saw the movie Godzilla and found it extremely scary, this could have created a very unpleasant negative memory in her mind for reptiles or animals. What is important to remember is the feeling that this memory of Godzilla brings. Whether Godzilla is factual or fictional is hardly the point of the discussion. For someone else like me, these fears could be trivial because the memories they bring don't make me feel terrible. But for a person like Isha, who has experienced them and on who that event left an extremely distasteful memory, these fears could alter their behaviors forever. I think this is the key here. Stored deep inside the walls of our brain attic, our memories and our choices are connected and shape our behavior and our lives. If the memory of a particular event is negative, chances are high that we will avoid that event or an event which is similar in experience. And if the memory of that particular event is positive or neutral, we will not hesitate to try it again. Let me make a confession here. When I was a kid, there was a series on TV called Giant Robot. Which were stories of a giant robot taller than a building, controlled by a young kid and his scientist father using a remote control watch. It was super cool in those days, and all of us would wait to see the show on Doordarshan. In every episode, Earth would be attacked by scary monsters and evil things, and giant robot and the kid would save the day. In one such episode, there was an ugly monster called the Mummy. It had a grotesque face and would appear from the darkness. It scared the hell out of me. From that day on, I avoid places which are dark because the moment I see a dark place, my mind would trigger this unpleasant memory of the Mummy with the grotesque face harming me, and I would decide not to venture in that place, even if it meant losing a treasure. In a brilliant TED talk on how fears and decisions are connected and what can we learn from our fears, Karen Thompson Walker narrates a wonderful story of a group of sailors. Somewhere in the beginning of the 19th century, these sailors, after being shipwrecked, were drifting in their lifeboats and were left with very little food and water. The closest islands from where they were at that time were the islands of Tahiti. But they had heard rumors that these islands were inhabited by cannibals. The other option was to go towards South America, but it would be a really long journey and they would run out of food. So option one was death by cannibals, and option two was death by starvation. And they all chose the option two, because deep inside their brain attics, their memory of cannibalism, which was probably formed through stories that they had heard from someone else, triggered a greater discomfort than their memory of starvation, which probably seemed less severe and discomforting than being eaten alive by cannibals. Karen Thompson Walker argues that our fears are actually powerful stories of our mind, and if we understand them better, we can deal with them better.
Our fears are an amazing gift of the imagination. A kind of everyday clairvoyance, a way of glimpsing what might be the future when there's still time to influence how that future will play out. Properly read, our fears can offer us something as precious as our favorite works of literature. A little wisdom, a bit of insight, and a version of that most elusive thing, the truth.
Now going back to the boulder and the newt. The moment I saw the boulder that morning, my mind imagined broken bones, squirts of blood, pieces of flesh, and many more such grotesque and vivid flashes. They probably came from the various books or movies I have seen, but this was an extremely unpleasant feeling which caused me to avoid climbing up that boulder. My logical mind then took over, and I saw no safety equipment to help me, which led to a confirmation bias. I put two and two together and made my decision. But on the other hand, I had no such flash or unpleasant feeling in my mind when I saw the newt. I thought it was a tiny little thing and I could squash it any time. So this explains why Isha and I behaved very differently that day. My decisions were connected to a memory flash in my mind and how that flash made me feel. Let us now see how this explanation answers the following questions. Why do we stall in taking our plunge to follow our calling and experience the zones? What are we so afraid of? There are two answers here. The first answer that I talked in detail till now is that inside our brain attics, we experience a fear which is triggered by an extremely unpleasant feeling brought by a flash of memory. This memory could be a factual or fictional one, which really doesn't matter here, as I talked earlier. The key point is the feeling brought by the memory. So let us go deeper into our brain attics, just like how Dumbledore would take Harry with the help of the pensieve. What is that memory in our minds? What is that core event that caused it in the first place? The answer is surprisingly simple, and we all know it because we have all experienced it. That event is called failure, and the feeling it causes can be many, like rejection, loneliness, sadness, humiliation, embarrassment, depression, defeated, and so on. I know what you all must be thinking. If all of us know it and all of us have experienced it, then why does each of us behave so differently? A classic example of this I often explain in my classes is how two students behave just a day before the exams. One of them is holed up in the library, revising every chapter one more time, and the other one goes to the basketball court to play just like he would play any other day. This is where Dan Kahneman's work, along with many more scientists, psychologists, and philosophers, provides deep insight.
From the point of view of the experiencing self, if you have a vacation and the second week is just as good as the first, then the two-week vacation is twice as good as the one-week vacation. That's not the way it works at all for the remembering self. For the remembering self, the two-week vacation is barely better than the one-week vacation because there are no new memories added.
Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, could be a daunting book to grasp, but is a fascinating one to read. He uses everyday examples to explain the concepts. His TED talk called The Riddle of Experience versus Memory is a gold mine of information, and I have taken many concepts that I explained above from it. All these brilliant minds have done a lot of work on how our cognitive biases and beliefs shape our behaviors. There is a heuristic called the peak-end rule that explains that a memory of an event is either based on the point where the experience of that event is at the peak or just before the end of the event, but not throughout the event. A common example of this heuristic is as follows. Imagine there's a person who goes to a restaurant, has a good experience when he was eating the main course, but in the end was served a horrible dessert. So his memory of the restaurant would be a memory of a horrible dessert he was served and not the one where he enjoyed the main course. This memory will get imprinted in his mind and will make him never go back to that restaurant, even if he actually enjoyed the food there, because the peak-end rule kicked in. The dessert is the peak moment of a meal, and this restaurant ruined it for him. The same analogy can be taken to the events of our life where we experience failure. Go back to the day in your childhood where you have just received your scores and realize that you have fared very badly. Your peak and memory of that event could be any of the three memories explained below. Memory 1. Our parents are very upset with us, and one of them even scolded us for doing so poorly despite all the facilities they have given us to study. You remember the sentence your dad saying to you, all you're expected to do is study and good grades. Even that you cannot do properly. Memory number two. You see all your friends enjoying and their family sharing sweets in the neighborhood. You especially feel jealous when your arch enemy, Rohan Kapoor, gets better marks than you and his father is boasting about how proud he is. But your family is sad. You just lock yourself in a dark room and stay there forever. Memory number three. You see the scores and show it to your parents. They smile at you and all of you go for dinner out to your favorite restaurant. Over dessert, your mum asks you, so what do you think you can do better next time? The peak end rule and the work of many other behavioral scientists like Kahneman can help us understand that those students who have memory 1 or 2 explained above would be the ones who are scared of exams and will end up in the library. And those students who have memory 3 will probably be at the basketball court. Let me pause for a minute. I'm not saying that students who are in the library are always scared and those who are in the basketball court are not. All I'm trying to say is that our behaviors and actions are shaped by the experiences and memories of those experiences. So when we want to take the plunge, our memory of failures is very important for us to move forward and take the plunge. If this memory is a good one, we will be able to take the plunge. But if not, we will stall. A major problem of our educational and social structures is that they don't encourage us to fail. Failing in many cultures is synonymous to being defeated or being punished. It can be a big stigma. In the corporate world, the exams are replaced by a performance management process. A promotion is considered victory, but a minor raise or a lack of promotion is considered a big black spot of failure on one's resume. And if you have not gotten a good raise and you see someone in your group getting promoted and throwing a party in which you are not invited, you feel worse, and this becomes your peak memory of that event. These flashes of memory are stories that bring a lot of discomfort and unpleasantness, which cause us to avoid taking the plunge and make us stall. The second reason is that besides the fear and the memories that associate the fear that we experience, we also experience something else. It is a sense of loss. Losing something is not easy for us. It drives us nuts. Some smart researchers have even coined a term for this feeling, loss aversion. To grasp this better, let us first understand why we enjoy gaining something as compared to losing something. We associate gaining something as some sort of a reward, a victory, a win, an achievement of sorts. We work very hard to win. We love to collect trophies in our lives that symbolize our achievements. But more importantly, we are extremely fond of the things that we gain or own and don't like to part with them. In fact, we give a lot of value to things that we own than the actual value of that thing. This is called the endowment effect. A child will not let go of his favorite toy. He will throw a tantrum when he's weaned off by his parents from his favorite pillow or blanket or bicycle. The value of that toy would be insignificant to the rest of the world, but to that child, it is of very high value. And as we grow older, we develop a deeper sense of entitlement on things that are around us or we have earned with our hard work. Letting go of these things will create the same unpleasantness as that of asking a child to let go of his favorite toy. He will throw a fit, and this fit is not fun for the child. So he will hold on to this toy forever. So imagine you have found your calling and are about to take a plunge. Would you find it easy to let go of your title that you have worked so hard to earn, the salary that you are getting, the social benefits that you and your family are enjoying? Or would you hold on to these things dearly? The actual value of these things could be low or insignificant, but to you, they are valued very high. This is why being an entrepreneur is so hard after one has been in a stable job regardless of the bank balance. it is not about the safety anymore. It is about losing and fighting the endowment effect in your mind attic to things that you have earned and hold very dearly. So despite knowing fully well that taking a plunge could be a good thing for us, here is the explanation on why we stall and don't take the plunge. The first reason is that we experience an unpleasant feeling caused by a deep memory flash in our brain attic, the source of which could be factual or fictional event of failure. And the second reason is that we don't like to lose things we own or feel entitled to. So what is the solution? How do we overcome the stall? How do we get used to failures and deal with the unpleasantness in our brain attics? I will give you 4 secrets to overcome the stall. The first secret is a simple word called practice. In the story of the boulder and the newt I told earlier in the episode, Isha had done rock climbing before. And with each climb, she knows how to handle herself during the process of climbing. This is how all sports people live. This is how all performing artists live. This is how astronauts train. This is how soldiers are made. They keep trying and practicing. Repetition is an age-old, tried and tested way to become better at a given task. It helps to reduce the anxiety and makes the person do the task better once they have done sufficient practice on it. Number 2, develop a habit to fail. No one can be spared from failure. They fail but learn how to deal with failure. They also experience negative feelings that come with failures. Dealing with failure can be cultivated like any other habit. A TED speaker, Jia Jiang, talks about this in a talk called What I Learned from 100 Days of Rejection.
When you get rejected in life, when you are facing the next obstacle or next failure, consider the possibilities. Don't run. If you just embrace them, they might become your gifts as well.
I recommend this talk to all my students. Just like how we learn to succeed, we must learn how to fail. And once we do, our ability to try new things and take the plunge to follow our calling will increase. Number 3, spring cleaning of your mind attics. This is hard to do but needs to be tried more. Every few years, I take a look at my own office, home, and spaces around me. I see things which have just accumulated over time. This goes on for a few months and it starts to bother my wife. She starts giving me hints that I better clean up my spaces. But I find it very hard to do. Not only it is time consuming, I feel that in that process, I might lose something very important. So I'm averse to loss and I feel really close to my things that I have accumulated over time. Slowly my wife's patience runs out and she gives me an ultimatum. Her tantrum is much worse an experience to handle than my loss aversion and endowment effects combined. So I clean them up and once I finish, I realize how lighter and empowered I feel. I was hoping to feel bad because my mind imagined that I might lose something. But on the contrary, once I cleaned up and let go of my things, I felt relaxed and happy. And suddenly I had brand new space to fill. The same analogy is true for our mind attics. Over time, it just accumulates junk. There are things that are just sitting there, taking up precious space that can be used for your plunges. So start cleaning your mind attics. Music and sports are extremely useful tools to clean up your minds regularly. And the last secret, talk about your bad experiences. Bring them out. Don't keep them locked up in your mind attics. They take up space and over time get stale and stinky. Slowly they start giving out foul gases that cloud your mind and won't let you think properly. find a counselor and vent this out, or maintain a diary where you write these things so that they come out of your mind attics. Some people laugh about their failures with their friends, which is a great way too. And finally, remember that fear is a little sister of all other emotion babies in your life. Don't treat it like a foster child. Treat it like how you treat all your other babies, with the same care and attention and love. Don't shove it under a carpet or ask it to go to the other room. Let it come out and play with all other emotions in your mind. Let it be like any other emotion. And slowly you'll become comfortable with having fear around you and deal with it better. My name is Rakesh Godwani and you're listening to Plunge. This podcast is brought to you by SUM, the School of Meaningful Experiences. For more information, visit www.sum.education. That's www.some.edu/cation.